Hey there, Sports History fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
If you're looking for a tough group of guys in the 1920s, I don't know if you can find much tougher ones than mechanics and fabricators from the rail yards of America's Midwest. Well, Chris Willis of NFL Films is going to come and share to us the story of the Columbus Panhandles, that tough team with a lot of family members in it, and it's all coming up in just a moment. This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we are podcasting from America's North Shore, bringing you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So in taking the snap from the sportshistorynetwork.com and handing off to pigskindispatch.com, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of pigskindispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have another great program tonight for you with our pre-World War II early pro football teams. And tonight we've got a real good one, one of the original teams coming out. When you think about Columbus, Ohio, that's what the story is going to be about tonight, how you think about football, but it's probably the Ohio State Buckeyes. But they had a professional team at the roots of early pro football. And we have a gentleman that grew up in Columbus, so he's very passionate about this Columbus Panhandles team. And that's Chris Willis, who is also the head of the NFL Films Research Library. So this man eats, breathes, and sleeps football history. And when you combine that with a passion of his hometown, I think we have a really exciting conversation we're going to have tonight. We'll bring him in right now. Chris Willis, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's a good topic to be talking about. So
I'm going to put a little precursor here. Now, Chris and I have talked beforehand, and we're going to be talking a lot about Joe F. Carr. As a matter of fact, Chris wrote the book, Joe F. Carr, The Man Who Built the National Football League. But we're going to sort of save some of the Joe Carr talk and the person of Joe Carr and save that for October 22nd on the man's birthday, where we're going to celebrate him a little bit more than with Chris. So tonight's going to be focusing in on the Panhandles and that franchise in Columbus. Chris, maybe you could start off with maybe a little bit of the origin of professional football and early football in Columbus.
Yeah. I mean, everybody, I think, if you're a football fan or maybe, you know, a fan of football history, you know, when you think of Columbus, Ohio, you most likely think of Ohio State football, you know, and rightly so. You know, I grew up there. I grew up going to Ohio State games and went to grad school there. So I'm a big Buckeye fan, you know, so, but I was always appreciative as I got older and as I learned a little bit more, especially about the pro football side of especially in Ohio, that Columbus had a very good, you know, team. You know, the Midwest was one of the big hotbeds, especially of early pro football, you know, Western PA, Ohio, you know, Michigan, you know, Illinois, Indiana, you know, all had, you know, a lot of good early teams and a lot of some of the town teams and, you know, where they got started. And Ohio was no different. You know, you had very good teams in Columbus, Akron, Canton, Maslin, Youngstown, you know, even then go down south, you know, with Dayton, you know, in north, a little bit north, west with Toledo, you know, Portsmouth, even, you know, to an extent. So you had a lot of good early town teams, you know, and that's how sort of was the lifeblood of some of the early pro game, you know, was, you know, it was not built on, you know, college football where you had a rivalry with the schools, you know, the old Western Conference or with the Big Ten, you know, those teams had, you know, geographical rivals. Well, when pro football was starting, a lot of it was your neighborhood town team, you know, like Canton and Akron, and Canton and Maslin was huge. You know, it's probably the first big, you know, pro football rivalry was Canton and Maslin. And, you know, Columbus would play Dayton, they would play, you know, Elyria, they would play Youngstown, they would travel, you know, whether it was north or south a little bit. And so, so that's how, you know, some of these town teams and sort of the rivalry, you know, and, you know, sort of got started, you know, especially in the Buckeye State, you know, over time, it was nicknamed the Cradle of Pro Football because that's where a lot of the good teams and the best players went to. You know, when teams from those towns were starting to pay players, you know, that's where some of the college All-Americans, you know, who you know, were 23, 24 years old, 25, and they still wanted to keep playing football and they could actually make some money, you know, because they had a name and, you know, reputation. And not to go too far into it, but a little bit was also that they would attract college players who played under assumed names. That was one of the big knocks of early pro football was, hey, the kid was good. And he was still even in college. He could make a, you know, a few bucks on Sunday playing under assumed name and, you know, sort of got a little bit of a black eye. And then they sort of, as the NFL sort of got started, those shenanigans, so to speak, were starting to be eliminated. But that's how some of these town teams sort of, and Columbus was right in there, you know, with the Columbus Panhandles.
Yeah. It had to be some really great, not really patriotism, but you know, citywide spirit, just having your own team and represented probably a lot like high school teams do today for towns. That's what it sounds like it was, but on a much bigger level with having the, you know, the professional paid players. So that's some exciting times there. So why don't you, if you could, tell us just a little bit about, you know, how we know we have a lot of football going on in the state of Ohio, but how in particular did the Columbus team come about?
Yeah, for the Columbus team, especially for the Panhandles, they were actually started. You probably think, okay, where did they get their nickname? You know, it's like, that's probably one thing.
Exactly.
Were they begging for money and stuff? That's the main thing that people think they begged for money. But the Panhandles got started really because they were a branch of the Pennsylvania Railroad. And the Panhandle Division, you know, the Pennsylvania Railroad, if you knew a little history, as it goes from east to west, had all these stops in different cities. And each of these cities would have what we call a Panhandle Division. And these Panhandle Division was, you know, boilermakers, machinists, and they would actually repair or remanufacture parts and labor for the trains. You know, so if a train, you know, needed some work, it would be, you know, sent to the sort of Panhandle shop. So it was pretty intense labor. You know, it's not easy work. So if you worked in these shops, you know, you were probably known as a pretty tough guy, or you didn't mind getting your hands dirty. You know, it definitely was not a blue collar. It was, you know. So in Columbus, the Panhandle Division, some of these guys who were, you know, sort of big and a little rough and tough and like to be physical, and football was starting to become a very, I wouldn't say popular because pro football wasn't popular at this time, but the college game was starting to become a little popular, but it was becoming a game that, you know, especially for some, maybe whether it's immigrants or sort of workers that, you know, only had Sunday off maybe, you know, to do this, you know, they wouldn't play baseball was played during the week sometimes. So some of these railroad workers would get together, everybody kind of assumes sometimes we talked about Joe Carr that he started the team, but he was a machinist in the Panhandle Division and was also a sports writer at the time. But he came a couple years later. It was actually started in 1901 with a fella who named William Butler, who was a fullback at the Ohio Medical University there in Central Ohio, which was sort of a rival with Ohio State. They actually played the Ohio State Buckeyes in a couple of early games in the early 1900s. And so William Butler, who had some of this experience, wanted to keep playing. And, you know, he saw a few, you know, some of the guys he works with, hey, let's start playing. And they end up playing. They did play Ohio State a couple of times in those, you know, in 1901, 1902, 1903 sort of time period. So that's how they got started in the Panhandle. Like I said, they only played maybe two games a year, two or three games a year, you know, because, you know, they had to find some other teams. And then it wasn't until around 04, 05, and then when Carr came around in 1907, that they started scheduling, you know, up to seven, you know, six, seven, eight, nine, 10 games a year, when there was more teams, more ability to schedule games and stuff. But William Butler, you know, is one of the guys that sort of should get credit for starting the Columbus Panhandles team.
Okay, so I take it he was probably one of their early stars in Butler for the team. I'm assuming having a little bit of football.
Yeah, experience. I mean, he only played the first year or two, you know, so he didn't last. Where, you know, he actually got a different job, but he was definitely the sort of organizer and then one of their better players, you know, because he had played some college ball and had some talent and stuff. And early, a few of the early newspaper recaps, his name not only was there for as an organizer, but also that he played well. You know, so if you got your name mentioned, then at least you're kind of standing out in at least the sports writer's minds.
Most definitely. And somebody 120 years later reads about you, then you know, sure, something worth mentioning.
Sure.
Now, okay. Now, I know it's not, we're not talking about too much about Joe Carr, but he is an integral part of the Panhandle's history. So how did Joe become involved with the Panhandles?
Yeah. I mean, he was a born organizer. You know, he grew up in Columbus in the Irish neighborhood there. He was really small in stature. You know, he was not bigger than like 5'7", 5'8". You know, like a buck 50, but he loved organizing the games. He loved knowing the rules, you know, he was popular with some of the baseball games in the neighborhood. And then, you know, then with the football team, but he really got his start in 1900 writing for the Ohio State Journal, became sports editor there. So he kind of knew some of the sports sort of circle in Columbus. So, but he also had to make money. Though, you know, sports writing was not a real full-time money-making salary, you know. So his main job during the day was a machinist, you know, which was a lesser job than the boilermakers and the sort of hardcore workers there, you know, in the sort of the oven, so to speak, there at the Panhandle division. So he was machinist. So he kind of knew, some of the players, and they all had sports as a passion, you know, because the team wasn't organized very well, you know, in those early years. You know, as good as Butler was as a player, he wasn't quite as good as an organizer. So Carr wanted to see this team succeed. So he sort of, built his team around this one sort of famous family, that I'm assuming, we'll talk to here. But he was excited about, sort of being a manager, being involved, especially with football. You know, baseball is obviously, the king of sports at this time. But Carr had a real love for football. It was his passion. And so he saw this as an opportunity. Hey, now I can run my own team. And, he got permission to reorganize the team in 1907. And that was his big sort of running off period of getting the team, out there and playing games again that fall.
Oh, okay. Now, were the Panhandles, were they company sponsored, or was it just because they all worked there and it was just a social group at that time?
Well, from what I know, from the research that I found, the Panhandle division in Pittsburgh doesn't exist anymore. You know, so the records were not kept. Was there was a Panhandle athletic board, so they kind of sponsored some events. In the early newspapers, they sponsored like track and field and baseball teams and football teams. So I think there was a chain of command, so to speak, but they were not sort of in charge of sort of funneling money to these events. They were more, hey, if you're an employee and you want to be part of a track and field event, or if you want to play baseball, you know, there was a Sunday baseball league in Columbus. The same thing with the football. You sort of volunteered. They were allowed to play, but they didn't technically were funneling money to go sign all American players. You know, the Panhandles played for well over 20 years. And they did not sort of recruit college All-Americans to play on their team, you know, which makes them very unique. They were above 500. They were a successful team without really any college All-Americans. You know, if you were the Canton Bulldogs, the huge story of 1915 was they signed Jim Thorpe for $250 a game. Well, Joe Carr never did that. He had to recruit from within the company, you know, and they really only made a few bucks from the gate. That, you know, they weren't paid $200 a game, you know, all the players. No, they made money from the gate for whatever the crowd came. So they really did it for love of the game, and not sort of, well, you know, like Ralph Hay owned the Canton Bulldogs, or Jack Cusack, who paid, Jim Thorpe. They were set up to, hey, we want to pay the best players. We're going to go out and recruit the best players. Well, the Panhandles were recruiting the best players pretty much from within the railroad workers. You know, every once in a while he might recruit an Ohio State player, but it was mainly, hey, if you want to work for the railroad, you can, then you'll be on the team. And very rarely did guys do that, because if you're a college graduate, the last thing you want to do is go work in a Boilermaker room. You know, you might go get a job that you know, with your degree, or you become a lawyer or a doctor, you know, or teacher. You know, you're not going to go bust your butt, you know, maybe in there if you can go be a lawyer. So that's how they sort of gathered their team members.
Now there's a lot to be said for that. You know, that there is probably some advantages to doing that. If you're working with somebody all day, you sort of know that person. And when you have the ultimate team sport of football, that could be extremely helpful. Whereas, you know, teams that are cobbled together from, you know, stars for around the country, maybe they don't have that camaraderie and devotion to each other and know each other as well. So maybe that gives us some advantages. Plus, if you go to work the next day and you had a poor game, I'm sure your buddies that you're working with are going to bust your chops a little bit. You don't want to face that. That's the peer pressure could be tremendous, you know. I'll bet.
Absolutely.
Okay, now, so did Joe Carr, did he play football with the Panhandles, or was he just from a sort of a managerial type figure?
He was just the manager. You know, he played baseball a little bit growing up, but he was not ever, you know, a football player or a professional athlete. You know, it was more, hey, I you know, he was in love with sports. He was a sports minded guy, you know, from a very early age. And he was sort of a born organizer. Like I said, he loved being, you know, sort of behind the scenes and sort of, you know, promote as a promoter or a team manager or sports writer. That's sort of where he made his mark.
Okay. All right. Well, with us getting this point, and you sort of foreshadow already that there's a very famous family of brothers that played on this team, that are the answers to a lot of trivia questions in football history, by the way. And maybe if we could talk about them and maybe some of the other famous players from these early Panhandles teams.
Yeah. I mean, when Carr took over, I mean, he was very fortunate, but I think he also was, you know, like I said, he knew what he had, you know, in the Panhandle yard at the railroad. There's a sort of famous football family, you know, obviously this is real early football history, is the Nessa brothers. And they were six of them that played for the Panhandles. There were actually eight boys. I believe there was almost, you know, 11 or 12 children that the Nessers were, you know, with the girls. But the six, and it's very odd because the biggest of the bunch was Pete, and who weighed almost like 300 pounds, worked at the Panhandles, and he never played. You know, you think the biggest of the group would be the one, probably the first one playing, you know, but Pete never played. And Ray is a mystery man. He was a tall, thin guy, you know, about 6 feet one, you know, 190 pounds. He appears in a few of the photos with his brothers, but he never appears in any lineups, you know, or any game recaps in the newspaper. And Ray was the only one that didn't work at the railroad. He became a police officer. So those are the two brothers that didn't work. But the other six were there pretty much the entire 20 years, you know, 20 plus years. And they were all sort of big guys, all very talented, all playing different type of positions. And you think that's pretty much half the team, you know? So, you know, and John and Phil were the two oldest. Then you had Ted, then Fred, then Frank, and then Al was the youngest. So those were the six Nestor brothers, you know, so, and they, like I said, they all played pretty much in the same time period. You know, Al was the youngest, who came in 1910. So by 1910, especially the time period between 1910 and 1970, right before World War One hit, that was the Panhandle sort of, you know, glory days, you know, because all six brothers were playing on the team. Then you had another halfback named Lee Snoots and played, you know, for a hand, you know, over, you know, 5 or 6 years too. And then you have another set of brothers, Roscoe Keener and Oscar Keener. And they were on the line. They were some tall, big, thin guys. you know. So all of a sudden, there's nine of the players, and then they also had a center who played a couple of years named John Snyder, and he actually married one of the Nesters' sisters. So that was a brother-in-law. So it was almost like a family affair. You know, they all worked together. Then they played on Sundays, played on the weekends, and they were and they were mainly a traveling team. So, but Carr could see that the Nesters were not only, like I said, they were talented and he could build around them and they lasted a long time, but people would be interested in seeing them play. You know, like if they were no good and they would constantly lose 40-0, which could happen in some of these early games, if you get a team that's just so much better, you know, there was a lot of, you know, especially with some of the pro teams, some teams were just not very good and nobody would come out and see them. But because the Nesters were very good, when they traveled to some of these towns, you know, especially in Ohio, they would attract, you know, a good crowd, you know, usually, you know, 1500 or 2000, they were routinely, you know, get between, you know, 2,500 to 5 to 6, sometimes 7,000, 8,000 fans, you know, because people at least knew, oh, wow, the Nesters are coming, the Panhandles are coming to town. This is going to be a good game. I want to see, you know, Toledo or Canton or Akron or Dayton play against the Panhandles. So that's what made them special, was that they had this great family or these great players that played for a long time, and they played well together. You know, like I said, maybe over the two decades, they were, you know, maybe once or twice they could have made argument they were the best team in pro football. Usually they were a notch below, you know, maybe the Canton and Akron at times, but they would play very competitive games and they were always there at the end, you know, whether it was a game or whether it was, you know, like, oh, you know, whether they were, how good they were and stuff. So, so the Nesters, like I said, especially if you're from Central Ohio, you're from Columbus, that they have a special sort of, just like Joe Carr, they have a special sort of recognition for that, for Central Ohio.
Okay. Now, I think it's interesting maybe to find out, Columbus is, like you said, Central Ohio. It's almost dead center on the map of Ohio. So they're almost equal distant to you know, the Akron, Canton area, to Toledo, to the Cincinnati and Dayton areas, Portsmouth. Who on the schedule was that one that they circled and said, okay, this is our rival, this is the game that we want to make sure we win? Who would have that been for the Panhandles?
Sure. Yeah, I think – mainly because they were a traveling team. So they didn't really have maybe like a crosstown rival, you know, maybe not be like the Chicago Bears against the Chicago Cardinals, you know, when they were crosstown rivals, because they were the best team in Columbus and they dominated those teams, you know, some of the sort of minor, lesser teams in Columbus. So I would say in the state of Ohio, definitely Dayton was probably the first one, the Dayton Oakwoods that became the Dayton Triangles, who eventually joined the NFL, was a charter member of the NFL, was probably one of their sort of main rivals, you know, 90 minutes away. Carl Stork, who was their longtime manager, who was with the Jim Cadets and the Oakwoods and then Triangles, kind of was very close with Joe Carr. So they had a nice little rivalry and even friendship. So, and then Canton was probably the other one. As the Panhandles in the sort of Canton Bulldogs got closer to when the NFL was founded in 1920, the Bulldogs were much better. But from like 1910 to 1915, you know, right when Jim Thorpe came along, or right before Jim Thorpe, that would be a decent game, just because Canton was always perceived to be very good and had some very good early teams. So anytime you played Canton and Maslin, that was always a big game. But I would think Dayton was the one. Going through the newspapers and game recaps, I think Columbus, you know, sort of had a little bit more of a budding rivalry, a clean, like, well, you know, clean as for the early days, but one that they liked. Hey, we liked going to Dayton, and Dayton liked playing Cleveland, so or Columbus. So that one I would mention first.
Okay. Now, so you've mentioned a couple of times here, most of these teams that we're talking about are in the state of Ohio, and there is in some writings, there is a mention of an Ohio League. And I know you have some feelings on that from your research. If you could tell us a little bit about what you think with this term Ohio League.
Yeah, I mean, at this time in pro football, there was no official league. You know, the NFL was the first true one, and that was established in 1920. So So the years, you know, preceding that, there was, and it came from some historians, and sometimes some sports writers would kind of use it like you would be the Ohio League champion. And what does that really mean? Because since there wasn't an official Ohio League, you know, they didn't have rules and bylaws. They didn't have a commissioner or a president. It was just more perceived with some of the sports writing at the time that, especially in Ohio, because that's mainly where a lot of the better teams were at the point, especially from about 1910 to 1920. So a lot of the best teams were playing in the Buckeye State. And so a lot of sports writers would take liberty to say, wow, you're the champion, but what were they champion of? And usually it was, you know, sort of near the end of the football season, the team that sort of had the best record and that was playing the best, they would schedule games against those other best teams. So a lot of times, like when Canton with Jim Thorpe was considered the Ohio League champion, it's because they were undefeated or their only loss, they sort of got revenge and beat that team much later in the season. And sort of they were the, what some historians call like the last team standing. So if Canton was, you know, 7-0 or 8-0, 9-0, and then they would play, you know, Maslin or Akron, who were, you know, 7-1, and they would beat them, then a lot of the sports writers, a lot of the headlines would say that Canton is the Ohio League champion or is the world champion of, you know, of pro football. Well, there was no official league, so that was more of a, you could say, a paper championship. But there is some validity to say, well, Canton was probably the best team with Jim Thorpe, you know, because they played the other best teams and they won, you know. So, but it was not an official league. It was more of a unofficial, in quotations, hey, look, here's your Ohio League champion, just because nobody in the state of Ohio, you know, could beat Canton, you know, because the majority of the teams, even like the Panhandles, they would play every Ohio team. A lot of the schedule was based on, hey, we're going to play Akron, we're going to play Canton, we're going to play Youngstown, Toledo, Dayton. And, you know, if we go, you know, 7-2, then we've had a good year, and our two losses were against a good Canton team and a good Akron team. And, you know, hey, we were pretty competitive, but we weren't the champion. So that's where that sort of moniker of Ohio League, you know, comes from.
Okay. Now, I guess, from what I'm understanding from reading your book, the, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the Panhandles went from sort of that, you know, we all work at the same place and we're going to go play some football on Sundays. So they started making a little bit of money, like you mentioned earlier. So they were almost like a semi-pro level. And eventually they got to be to the professional level and getting into the American, the APFA pre-NFL league, like you just said. So how does that progression go, and how was the Panhandles part in that?
Well, like we mentioned, they were always one of the better teams in the Ohio League. You know, like I said, maybe they weren't the best. You know, they weren't quite, you know, with Canton Bulldogs with Jim Thorpe or at that level. But they're always perceived to be one of the, you know, maybe three or four best, you know, two or three best teams always in the Ohio League for, you know, almost 20 years. So because of that, and because of Joe Carr's sort of guidance, they were always going to be maybe there once the league, maybe a league was founded. You know, Carr always wanted that, you know. So in 1920, when they had the meeting in Canton and they started the league, you know, a lot of those Ohio teams were charter members because of this is where the better teams were. This is where the organization was and they wanted it done. And that's how it got started. And that's why the Panhandles now, the only unfortunate thing at that point was all the Nesters were very old at this time. The team had gotten old by 1920. I mean, they had been around since 1901, like I said, and reorganized in 1907. So that was 13 years or 13 seasons, you know, by 20, you know, if you look it up, you know, the three oldest were in their 40s, you know, the two oldest, John and Phil, were already in their 40s. Ted Nesser was around 37, 38 years old. Fred and Frank were in their mid to early 30s. And Al was the youngest, and he was around 27, 28 years old. And by that time, he wanted to get paid. So, you know, after World War I, like 1919, he left the Panhandles and went to Akron. And he was a part of those early good Akron teams where the Akron Pros with Fritz Pollard, which won the first APFA or NFL title. Well, Al was a part of that. He was not playing for the Panhandle. So it's a little unfortunate that by the time the league started in 20 and then 21 and 22, the Panhandles were kind of an older team. And like I said, they weren't in the business to recruit all Americans. They weren't going to pay, you know, $100-$150 a game. You know, Al Nesser could make, you know, $100-$150 playing for the Akron Pros. Well, they just weren't going to do that. They're just going to play whatever the gate made. They would split. And like I said, they made $20. That's $25 for that game. Then that was it, you know? So it's a little unfortunate that they had been pioneers and they kept the game going. They were one of the better teams. Like I said, they had a built-in attraction with the Nessers, but really by the time, you know, the NFL was founded, they had, you know, sort of run their course, because 1922 was the last year that they actually played under the Panhandle's name. They played a couple more years under the Columbus Tigers, and they recruited some Ohio State players, and they tried to pay a little bit more. But by that time, you know, Joe Carr could see it that the city of Columbus was all about Ohio State football. And if a citizen of Columbus was going to pay for a football ticket, they're going to try to pay for an Ohio State football ticket and not, you know, come out to see the Columbus Tigers on a Sunday, you know. So eventually he sort of moved away from an NFL team in the city of Columbus.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. Now, I guess every team, if you have a group together, especially if you have, nine of them are in some way related to other members on the team, there's got to be some good stories, especially with them traveling around Ohio, playing the majority of their games on the road. Do you have any good stories you could share with us that would be entertaining?
Yeah, I mean, they were a very interesting and entertaining sort of group of players, as you can tell. I think the couple of stories, you know, I'll say them kind of quickly, so they won't be too long. But the first one I think is very interesting is because they were full-time workers at the railroad, a lot of their practices were done during their lunch hour. You know, so, you know, a lot of pro teams weren't practicing, you know, daily or at night or whatever. A lot of times they would get together on Saturday or Sunday morning before the game, and they go through some plays, and then they go play the game. And then a lot of the players would separate. They would go to the city that they lived in because they were being paid to come in and play for that team. Well, the Panhandles always originated from Columbus, so a lot of their practices were during their lunch hour. So I've heard stories from the families and from the players, you know, some interviews in newspapers that say, oh yeah, they would woof down their lunch in the first 15 minutes, and then it would take 45 minutes to help practice. So they would kick, and it'd be a lot of just maybe fundamental, you know, kicking, punting, throwing, you know, catching, you know, maybe, you know, learning a few new plays. They were mainly a running team, you know, throw a pass in there every once in a while. So that always would sort of make me laugh, like, oh my God, here's an early pro football team, and really the only way they're practicing is during like a 45 minute lunch hour. You know, now if it was raining, I've heard from the family, like, they would play like cards or you know, euchre or something like that just to pass the time because they didn't want to go out and practice in the rain. You know, so, and you got to think, these are guys in their work boots and their overalls, and they're out there pretty, you know, it wasn't like they brought their cleats to probably, you know, they would just practice and then they would go play. And so, and then traveling, yeah, because that was one thing that we could have talked about with Carr, was one of the things that made them such a success over those two decades was that they could ride the railroads for free. So that was a huge thing of why they eventually became a full-time, really traveling team. They would only play like one game against the other good team in Columbus at the end of the year, usually, is because they had free passes to travel. So he wouldn't have to pay for traveling. He wouldn't have to pay to rent a park if you wanted to play local games all the time. Security, print up tickets, you know, have, a doctor there. Like, you know, that's all expensive if you want to put on a game locally. Well, because they traveled everywhere, he didn't have to worry about that. You know, so that's why whatever the gate was, they would make it, you know, they'd hop on the train for free and they would go back and they would be home and they'd back to work on Monday. So traveling was a huge thing for them. They enjoyed it. It was a way to get away maybe from the family for a day, you know, leave Saturday afternoon, come back Sunday night and just get away a little bit, go play a game with your brother. Like I said, you had five other brothers or a brother-in-law and you played with people that you liked, that you worked with. There is some things that said that even to save some money, say they might've gotten to town a couple hours earlier than they should. Sometimes they would go find a barn, you know, sort of outside of town and just sort of sleep it off a little bit. So they wouldn't have to actually go, rent a room at a couple rooms at a hotel or a little place to stay. And then they would go play the game. Then they would hop on the train and come back and stuff. So very unique team, like I said, especially at a time, we're sort of, those barnstorming games were mainly sort of at the end of the year to make some money, but they did it full time, especially from like 1910 on, that they were pretty much a full time traveling team, with maybe no more than one or two games in Columbus every year.
Huh. That's got to be a tough way to play football traveling. We know there's a lot of those early pro teams that had to do that. Duluth comes to mind, but that was for different reasons. Now, I appreciate you coming on here and sharing your passion for pro football, especially the pro team from your hometown. And if you could you tell us again the name of your book and where people could get that book? It's on Joe Carr and the Panhandles.
Yeah, I mean the Columbus Panhandle is from Rowan. Rowan and Littlefield is the publisher. So if you go to Rowman Rowan. .com or Amazon, you can find it. It's Columbus Panhandles, the complete history of pro football's toughest team, from 1900 to 1922, which was their time span. It's got all the seasons. It's got some really good stories. It's got some player profiles. And then in the back, like I said, it has all the game box scores. So if you're really into stats and box scores, all of them, the lineups are all in there. So almost pretty much every single game that they played, for 20 plus years is all there. So, and then the Joe Carr book is also on both sides. And, Joe F. Carr, the man who built the National Football League, it was also from Rowan Littlefield. So if you want to learn a little bit more about Joe Carr, because his career, I mean, we just touched on a little bit of his career with the Panhandles. He was actually, big pioneer in the founding of the NFL and was the president for two decades there. Like I said, when we talk a little bit more, maybe in October, you'll get to learn even more about his career, which is very, very special. So those are the two volumes if you're interested in reading more.
Okay. Well, I think you've whetted all of our appetites. I think we're going to be hitting Amazon as soon as we get done listening to this and picking up those books, because this is a very interesting topic by a very good writer you are, Chris. And we appreciate you doing us on all this great football history, writing about it and, joining many podcasts and talking about it and your great work on NFL films. So we appreciate that. And we appreciate your time today. And thank you very much for joining us again. And we can't wait to talk to you in October.
No, I appreciate you having me on. Like I said, you guys with the Sports History Network and the podcast, like I said, you guys are doing a tremendous job of getting the history out there, on a daily basis. So I appreciate the effort you guys do. And like I said, this is always fun to talk about this era.
All right. Thank you very much, Chris.
Sure.
At the Sports History Network, we're all about sports yesteryear, and so we're so pleased to introduce you to Row One, an online memorabilia gallery and shop that brings your sports history to life anywhere. The Row One gallery includes over 5,200 gorgeously reproduced prints of team posters, game program covers, game tickets, advertisements, and more in baseball, pro and college football, pro and college basketball, and more. And any gallery item may be printed in a variety of sizes on wood, metal, canvas, acrylic, or poster paper. And in Row One shop, check out the thousands more of unique items with a retro and historical designs dating back to 1876, including t-shirts, long sleeve shirts, phone cases, mugs, blankets, pillows, towels, and even shower curtains. Go to sportshistorynetwork.com, ROW1, for access to the full Row One catalog and for gallery prints and gift items. Plus get a 15% discount off all prints on the Row One Pictorum Gallery with coupon code SHN15. Follow the link on the show notes. That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.